91.3 WLRN presents South Florida Arts Beat. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Today on a fundraising edition, musician Bobby Ingram talks about the local folk music boom in the 60s and the 50th anniversary of the Flick Coffee House and their upcoming folk music events in Coral Gables. Judith Bishop speaks with Fairchild Tropical Botanic Gardens COO Nanette Zapata about their exciting new art center. Stay with us to catch the conversation and information coming up on South Florida Arts Beat right after these news updates from NPR and the WLRN Miami Herald News. Welcome back to a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, Judith Bishop tells us about the new art center at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. South Florida will celebrate its folk music history Friday the 28th through Sunday the 30th at the Titanic Pub and Brewery, 5813 Ponce de Leon Boulevard in Coral Gables. That's just south of the University of Miami's Mark Light Stadium. That site used to be the location of the iconic folk club known as the Flick Coffee House in the 1960s. It presented some of the best singer-songwriter talent from that era: Joni Mitchell, Steve Goodman, David Crosby, Jerry Jeff Walker, Tom Rush, and John Sebastian, along with renowned South Florida talent Fred Neil, Vince Martin, and Bobby Ingram. Actor and comedian Gabe Kaplan will MC the 50th anniversary of The Flick next weekend, featuring Vince Martin, Chuck Mitchell, Michael Smith and Barbara Barrow, Kevin Hurley, and Bobby Ingram, among other singer-songwriters. We recently spoke with Coconut Grove's folk musicologist Bobby Ingram about those heady times. Bobby Ingram, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. It's an honor to have you with us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell me, what was Coconut Grove like way back in the early to mid-60s, and what were some of the places you'd frequent?
Well, when I first came to the Grove, it was actually to do a kind of a site survey. I had met Vince Martin up in the other end of town, up in around the 79th Street Causeway, and I had lived in Miami. This would be about 1960. I had lived in Miami since the early 50s. But part of that time I'd spent in the Navy. And the first transition that was kind of abrupt for me was going from it was so ordinary in Miami Shores, I mean, so middle America in 1950s, and then I went to Key West and Harrison, and this crazy conch town in the 50s. It was a sailor town, Navy, it was Navy and Marines. I had an attitude towards Key West, you know. And when I came back and went down to the Grove with Vince to look at where we were going to build a coffee house, the first thing I saw was Key West, but, you know, there's no shore patrol. You know, and it was so, Eddie, it was so laid back. It was so incredibly laid back, and it was a funky little village, and it was kind of the little town at time forgot for about 10 or 20 years, you know, between that Second World War years when the Grove was a boomtown with Pan Am and all the greats. This history of ours, it's being ignored right now with this new Bayside thing that they're going to put down there. But Pan Am was down, the Coast Guard base was still there, there were still helicopters coming in and practicing, and once in a while, I guess it was a flying boat once in a while, but that whole era had ended at the end of the Second World War, and all of the whole aviation things changed so dramatically and went up to 36th Street. Mm-hmm. And so the Grove was, you know, was this boom town just before that, military town, you know, a couple of times, the first Spanish-American War, too, and then it was suddenly just this quiet little town.
Some refer to it as paradise.
I've been living in paradise long enough, and I would have to agree that it's the closest thing I can imagine. I've been to Maui, but I've been to Guam, and I'd prefer Coconut Grove to Guam, that's for sure.
What were some of the places there that you'd frequent?
We ate at the Florida Pharmacy, which is now still on the corner of McFarland and Maine. The model of the Grove, the town model, was a lot like Miami Springs, Miami Shores, Alapata, Little River. You had the drugstore on one corner. You know, you had maybe a garden supply shop from one another corner, a bank, a gas station. They were all converged. Like Second Avenue was that way in the Shores. Second Avenue is that way in Little River.
Yeah.
You know, the Grove was that way in 1960.
Were there any clubs in the Grove at that time for music?
The nearest music venue was probably Millard Ward's Last Word, which was up on 27th, just on the other side of Cross Street. Moore Shell Lumber is now where that empty lot is. But it's a kind of a, the first time I went there was kind of concurrent with the same era with another friend of mine, a friend of mine from Little River. And we went into the Last Word, and it was atypical. The waitresses had blue eyeshadow, and everything was very mysterious, you know. It was terminally hip. Yeah.
Now tell me something. You preceded the rush of musicians down from New York and other places.
We created the rush.
You were there before it happened. Freddie Neil went up there and played in Greenwich Village in the early 60s, and he said, I got to get the heck out of here. Forget the snow. I'm going back.
Chronologically, the way it happened was, the first coffee house actually, in fact, did not open. It was not in the Grove. It was on the other side of U.S. 1 on Douglas Road at 37th Avenue. It was called, quaintly, the Coffee House. And some other investors from Miami Beach, friends of ours, Myron and Joan Jacobs, and they actually got the place open. Vince and I didn't actually get it open, but we instituted the whole concept and spent my money. And then I went back. I was in the Merchant Marine at the time. I went back to the ships. I was working for the oil companies on tankers. And then it finally did open up. Shortly after it opened up, another friend of ours, a guy named Larry Marks, whose father was in the clothing business here, right, Larry Marks Fashions, decided he wanted to open one up, and he opened one up in Fort Lauderdale. And it was just, it had a ripple effect. A little coffee house with a couple of kids from the University of Miami that were music students, probably. I remember Mike Clow was one of those early guys. Keel Martin from Hill Street Blues came in. He was a kitchen guy. Then the Catacombs opened in Fort Lauderdale, and it was a very, very nicely done. And my roommate, actually, at the time, Gordon Hooper, was a restaurant designer or kitchen designer. He worked for Edward Don. And he helped him design the club, and the club worked. It only had 80 seats. So a lot of nights, when we turned a PA, such as it was, PAs, they were hi-fi systems with little Shure mixers, you know what we had. And lighting was a coffee can with a yard lamp in it, you know. But the room, I mean, you go in rooms, some rooms now are so user hostile when it comes to music, you know. And some rooms, you know, just still work.
So those two got it started for the Flick. They paved the way for the Flick.
Well, it started the exodus, because what happened was that Vince went up to the Village where he had connections. He had played it in the Terriers in Greenwich Village. I mean, at that time, the Playboy Club was opening up. Mm-hmm. The Lambs Club, which was a spin-off clone of the Playboy Club, which is down where by 1800 was opened up. And suddenly, this trio called Peter, Paul, and Mary was in my living room hanging out.
Wow.
Because they were friends of Vince's. We had an apartment up in what is now Wynwood, but was on Gordon and I had an apartment. It was on 46th Street over in an upholstery shop. And suddenly we're in the midst of this, peripherals of this folk scene is starting to drift down. First with Peter, Paul, and Mary, then the Clancys come down and play at the Playboy Club.
We're talking early 60s?
Early 60s, yeah. You know, 61, 62. Mm-hmm. And I'm suddenly in heaven. I'm with these people, and I could play enough. My father was a guitar player, so I could play enough guitar to hang with these guys.
Yeah.
And it all just began to evolve, and then the coffee house got open, and we actually had a gig. It was $10 a night, and we knew it wasn't a lot of money, but it was great fun. And then the word started going. Vince went back to New York, and that was when he met Freddie. He didn't know Freddie, I don't think, until then.
Fred Neil.
And Fred was a Florida boy anyway, because he was from St. Pete, from Treasure Island. So he'd grown up in Florida. He had no problem with, you know, that transition. And Vince brought him back to Miami.
And we're going to pick up with that in our second segment here on South Florida Arts Beat with our guest, Mr. Bobby Ingram. We'll return to the conversation with Bobby Ingram about the 50th anniversary of the Flick Coffee House in just a moment after we get those pledge lines ringing. Please stay with us. And we're back on South Florida Arts Beat with Bobby Ingram for our second segment. So, Bobby, the folk scene really started energizing. Peter, Paul, and Mary show up in your living room. People are coming down from New York. Freddie Neil is bringing down John Sebastian and on and on. Give us a sense of those exciting times.
Well, I like to think in chronological terms what was going on and that caused that to happen. Another coffee house opened up on 32nd Avenue, parallel to where this Douglas Road coffee house was. So now we got three venues. And then another coffee house opened up in Fort Lauderdale, down by right where the tunnel goes under, yeah, by Las Olas there. And it was called the Cafe Pegasus. And I get a phone call to go up to Pegasus and work, and the opening act is a comic named George Carlin, who was down from the village, you know. Well, that was a rowdy week. And George and I had a lot. I was from Rockaway Beach, and George was from Manhattan, but I think the Rockaway thing had come up, but we were pretty compatible, I mean, as far as wise guys go, you know. But that was going on. And then when we got into the Catacombs thing, Tom Rush showed up from Boston. And Tom was golden. I had a recording that I'll give you some time. It's been digitized of Tom Rush doing an easy 20 minutes. And he was 20 years old. He was an English major at Harvard. But he was brilliant. Fred was on that tape. Fred Neil, Vince Martin, David Crosby playing a nylon string guitar. David showed up in town, came in on a Greyhound bus with a guy named Kevin Ryan. Kevin was so glad to get rid of David. He says, this guy keeps saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? You know, all the way from New York City in a Greyhound bus. I mean, a 20-year-old.
Reminds me of Midnight Cowboy.
Are we there yet? Well, this was the first cut. This was the cut that didn't make the movie, you know. And that's how I met Cross. I met him in Larry Marx's living room down on Bayshore Drive. And Dave and I was sitting across each other with guitars, and we started singing harmonies. And that friendship is still going on today.
Now, the flick all of a sudden shows up on quite a prolific scene, three or four different folk clubs. How is it distinct?
The flick was the last of the clubs. It was the least likely in the sense of the way the other clubs were developing. At pretty much where the folk era was kind of winding down, people were beginning to hear about this band from England called the Beatles. I remember David and I in the parking lots of these coffee houses playing and comparing what Bob Gibson was writing in the folk world on his 12-string and what these English guys that we were just starting to hear about were writing. And we were finding some kind of a connection between what we were all doing that attracted us to that. Along comes a gentleman comes down from Nova Scotia, I believe it was, a guy named Max Lawner. This is the most amazing story because Max was a retired photographer who had a photo studio in Canada where he took photo, you know, pictures of families and whatever. Comes to Miami. Alan, this is his attorney, this guy, convinces him that what he really needs to do in his retiring years, his golden years, is to open up a coffee house. And Max goes for it.
Wow.
And I mean, at the end of the folk era, when everybody else is starting to plug in, Max opens this place that looks like Swenson's
ice cream
parlor.
Yeah.
Vince goes to New York on a mission to find some frou-frou. He comes back with signed Tiffany lamps. And one of these huge Italian coffee machines with the griffin on top with the wings and the hooves, you know, and the medieval stuff. You know. And we had it all going on.
Wow.
And he opens this coffee house. It was the winter of 1964 because my boy Liam was born in April of 64, and we were playing there, and his mother was working Karen was working there as a waitress that night when Liam was born in South Miami Hospital. But so it had to be in the early winter. David and I had been in a folk group in California.
David Crosby.
Broke up. We went our separate ways. He went to Chicago. I came home. He came back down. There was a little bit of animosity about the band being broken up and everything. And that was settled. And we both went to work in this brand new club. Vince, a girl named Chloe, who I wish I could remember her last name, Osbach, who became the bass player, was banging our gang later on. Vince, Oz,
Vince
me.
Martin.
The coffee house crowd, basically. Yeah. We moved over into this place with Mr. Lawner, who was the owner and manager of the place, and that was when the fun began. Because, I mean, it couldn't be a less compatible combination of personalities than these hippie musicians and Max Lawner. As the club developed, his favorite trick of all, the one that really endeared him to all the musicians, was he had a switch installed by his cash register. And it was hooked up to two lights that were on either side of the stage. And when he was tired of you, he would turn the switch and the lights would go on, flash off and on. And this was your signal, you got one more song. Oh, God, he was a piece of work.
Now, he didn't do that to Joni Mitchell or David Crosby or Jimmy Buffett or Jeff Walker or Dion or Tom Rush or John Sebastian.
He did
some
not
of the people who played the
discriminate. He did not discriminate. He told Joni to sing something that people knew, and she didn't. Mm. She made it up herself anyway.
Mm-hmm.
He was funny. He was just funny.
What a stellar list of musicians.
They all came through there. Johnny came through there eventually. I did with, when Sebastian played there, I wasn't there. I was there working over at Monty's.
Mm-hmm.
But Joni played with Chuck Mitchell, who will be on this show, was an ensemble player at the Flick. He was a regular at the Flick. By then, we had the Gaslight going over in the Grove, and Joni would come over and play at the Gaslight, which is where she met David. That story gets real complicated in there. But yeah, Dion was making a comeback. He had recorded Abraham and Martin and John. Lise Campbell was his manager.
Lise Campbell, he's a great producer.
Yeah, and came into the Flick, and nobody could. We weren't sure who Dion was because we were folkies.
Mm-hmm.
And he got up there, and he just was such a rocker with an acoustic guitar, and he just his whole groove integrity was just incredible. You know, he was just fun to watch and fun to sing with and everything. And then we discovered that we went to the same Catholic boarding school in New York.
Well, listen, we've unfortunately run out of our time with Bobby Ingram, the musicologist, singer, songwriter, folk musician for decades here in South Florida, and it's wonderful to have you come on South Florida Arts Beat and give us a sense of a great history, Bobby. And my last question is, who's going to write the book?
Well.
You, sir. How about that?
I can spell.
You work your way around a computer pretty well. So here's my hint. Please consider doing that with all of your friends that are still with us. And that's a book that I definitely want to read and a great chapter in South Florida music history. And Bobby Ingram, thank you so much for joining us here on South Florida Arts Beat.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. It's been a pleasure, as it always is, to come down to WLRN. I don't know what we'd do without the station. A lot different city, I'll tell you.
Once again, the 50th anniversary of the Flick Coffee House takes place March 28th, 29th, and 30th at its former site, which is now the Titanic Pub and Brewery, 5313 Ponce de Leon Boulevard in Coral Gables. Limited seating is available. For more information, go to Eventbrite.com. Actor and comedian Gabe Kaplan is the MC, and the show will feature Bobby Ingram with Chuck Mitchell, Michael Smith, Barbara Barrow, Vince Martin, Kevin Hurley, and so many more. Please stay with us here on South Florida Arts Beat, and please keep our pledge lines ringing during our fundraising edition. We'll be right back. Welcome back to a fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Please keep our pledge lines ringing while the show is on the air. The conservation and education-based Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden now offers a new venue that will feature art, music, and their rich cultural and botanical exploration history. Here's Judith Bishop to tell us more.
Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden is an 83-acre oasis on Old Cutler Road. Fans call it a Garden of Eden, a place where the mission is to preserve tropical plant diversity. The garden first opened in 1938 under the watchful and enthusiastic eye of its founder, Robert Montgomery. He named it after David Fairchild, his good friend and a champion of collecting tropical foliage and saving it from extinction. The garden was designed by William Lyman Phillips, an associate of legendary park architect Frederick Olmsted. Here to give us an insider's view of Fairchild and its exciting new art center is Chief Operating Officer Nanette Zapata. Nanette, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. I think you'll find it interesting to know that a few years ago on this program, we reported on a poll, what is your favorite tourist attraction in South Florida? And number one, numero uno, far and away, was Fairchild Garden. And ever since then, your organization has been on even more of an upward trajectory. You're undergoing a renaissance at this time, and one of the big happenings there, of course, is the new art center. Tell us about it, its origination, and what we can expect from it once it opens in April.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me, Judy. It's always a pleasure for Fairchild to be with you and to experience this renaissance with your listenership. I think Fairchild is really a fantastic cultural destination for South Florida. It's the oldest cultural institution in South Florida. And the Arts Center is really a capstone for what has been described as an art experience for the botanic garden world. During the Renaissance, gardens and artists were merged. They were the muse. The garden was the muse of the artist. And sometime after that, gardens became walled off spaces and a little bit more colonial. And only within the last 15, 20 years has that experience been removed. And now the garden is once again the muse. And I'm really pleased that Fairchild has been leading that charge so successfully over the last 12 years.
We have an excellent reputation, not only here in South Florida, but nationally as well. And now, as you say, the capstone is your new art center. What are you going to call it, and what kind of programs can we expect to attend there in the near future?
So the art center is called the Adam Rose and Peter McQuillan Art Center, and it is named after the donors who are, of course, supporting this incredible infrastructure and programmatic endeavor of the garden. And among the many things you can expect are works on paper, concerts, theater, movies. Really, it's a house where art will reign queen. And it's going to be terrific fun, and we'll have a lot of programs and a lot of curatorial experiences for anyone who wants to enjoy the arts.
Are the films and the concerts going to have some sort of a peg to flowers, palm trees, gardens, or is it going to be more generic in approach?
I think it really depends on what is proposed. I think one of the things that we're mindful of at Fairchild is that we're really a gateway. And one of the things we really like to focus on is the ability to be very broad in our ability to attract people to the world of botany, so to speak. And so one of the things we like to do is keep attractions and keep activities and exhibits very broad-based and then lure people with those into the garden and then teach them about the importance of conservation, botanical heritage, eco-literacy. And all of those things happen as a result of our ability to pull people through. And so it really just depends. We've had terrific artists, sculptural artists over the years, and a lot of the times they've had fantastic works on paper that we have not been able to exhibit. Now we can. We've had one of the things that we're working on is a partnership with O Cinema and have streaming performances of, say, the Bolshoi and a musical performance at the same time at Fairchild. So there's a lot to be done and there's a lot to think about. And I think the broader we think and the wider we think and the more innovative we are, the better the performances and the output will be.
In the past, you've been very innovative with visual arts, the Chihuly, the Liechtenstein. They were fantastic. And I know they attracted large, large crowds to the garden and introduced people to Fairchild, perhaps. Do you have anything of that scope coming up in the next year or two?
We do. And we'll be able to make an announcement right here exclusively in a few months. I promise we'll come back and tell you. It's a big one.
Okay.
We're just not quite ready. I don't mean to be a little coy about it, but we're not quite ready, but it's going to be huge for sure.
Well, we'll look forward to breaking that news right here on South Florida Arts Beat. Fairchild is a place of beauty and serenity, but it's also a science lab of sorts, known for its botanical research. And you've forged some alliances with the University of Miami, FIU, and the University of Florida. What kinds of joint ventures are you doing with those academics and scientists and botanists?
The beauty of science education today is that Miami, in particular, is having a tremendous effect in removing that dreaded brain drain that happens. We have so many talented students right here in South Florida. And if they have an interest in science, sometimes they have to go away. They have to study in universities that are not necessarily local. And in partnerships with these local universities, we're able to keep those students here. We're able to create the environments that they need to study tropical plants, science, the botany of the tropics. And they're able to then become scientists right here in South Florida. And how that all happens is this fantastic education pipeline program that starts at pre-K and runs all the way through graduate school. So we have students from pre-K through graduate school getting postdocs at Fairchild all the time. And so we're single-handedly responsible for 200,000 students a year becoming contacted with science, tropical science, botany, and conservation. And it's really a remarkable story when you think about the importance of the role that a botanic garden has. To be able to deliver that kind of success is really incredible.
So you approach it from many, many angles, a serene place of beauty, a tourist attraction for a Sunday afternoon, a botanical laboratory, mm-hmm. and now an art center. Lots going on there. I think most people think varieties of palm trees, perhaps, when they think of your gardens, and that's certainly center stage. But there are many exotic herbs and your fabulous orchids. In fact, it is the home of the American Orchid Society. A little apocryphal story. When I lived in New York for many years, getting an orchid was rather remarkable because they were so prohibitively expensive. And down here, you can get one on a truck for $10 or $12. Tell us about the variety of orchids and what it is, other than the climate down here, that makes it so conducive and orchids so plentiful.
I think biologically, we're all drawn to flowers, to colorful flowers. I think it's something ingrained in our evolutionary biology. And orchids in particular, they have a sensuality and a mystery to them that is really universal. I think everybody reacts to them. Even if you don't know plants, you find the beauty. And I think biologically, I think we're also lured to beauty. And I think there is not one unattractive orchid that anyone can necessarily point to. So the fact that we have this budding relationship with the American Orchid Society, that's just remarkable. And this great new orchid collection that we didn't have a couple of years ago. And orchids are now part of our ecology, just like palms and our hardwood trees are. It's really incredible. Now, you link that with our mango collection, our fruit program, our palms, our cycads, the incredible landscape design, and you really have a world-class botanic garden, unlike anything else you can find certainly in this country, but certainly in the world.
You're absolutely right. There are many, many botanic gardens, but only one Fairchild. We thank you so much for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
And thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Fairchild Garden is open every day but Christmas. The grounds usually open at 7:30 in the morning and close at 4:30. But the shop, tea house, and festivals have slightly different hours, so it's best to get the latest information by logging on to fairchildgarden.org or telephoning them at 305-667-1651. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment. Before we go, let me mention that USA Today recently launched their 10 Best Reader's Choice Best Public Garden Competition. 20 gardens in the U.S. were selected as nominees, and Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden is one of them. Fairchild is asking the South Florida community to cast their vote. To do so, go to 10best.com/awards/travel/best-public-garden to vote through March 31st. Voting is free and there's no need to register. Winners will be announced on April 2nd. Good luck, Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. Thank you so much for your kind contributions made during the show. They act as a vote of confidence for arts coverage here on WLRN. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. Tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. That's today's fundraising edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributor, Judith Bishop. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information, 305-995-2221, or email it to us at info@wlrn.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye, enjoy,